Now, will you further turn with me, please, to Daniel's book? We're in chapter 3 tonight. Daniel chapter 3, beginning at verse 1. Nebuchadnezzar the king made an image of gold whose height was 80 cubits. And the breadth of it 6 cubits, he set it up in the plain of Jura in the province of Babylon. Then Nebuchadnezzar the king sent to gather together the princes, the governors, and the captains, the judges, the treasurers, the counselors, the sheriffs, and all the rulers of the provinces to come to the dedication of the image which Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up. Then the princes, the governors and captains, the judges, the treasurers, the counselors, the sheriffs, and all the rulers of the provinces were gathered together unto the dedication of the image that Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up. And they stood before the image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Then an herald cried aloud, "To you it is commanded, O people, nations, and languages, that at that time that you hear the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, sackbut, psaltery, dulcimer, and all kinds of music, ye fall down and worship the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar the king hath set up. And whosoever falleth not down and worshipeth shall the same hour be cast into the midst of a burning fiery furnace." Therefore at that time, when all the people heard the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, sackbut, psaltery, and all kinds of music, all the people, the nations, and the languages fell down and worshipped the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up. Wherefore at that time certain Chaldeans came near and accused the Jews. They spoke and said to the king, "Nebuchadnezzar, O king, live forever. Thou, O king, hast made a decree that every man that shall hear the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, sackbut, psaltery, and dulcimer, and all kinds of music, shall fall down and worship the golden image, and whosoever falleth not down and worshippeth, that he shall be cast into the midst of a burning fiery furnace. There are certain Jews whom thou hast set up over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, have not regarded thee. They serve not thy gods, nor worship the golden image which thou hast set up." Then Nebuchadnezzar, in his rage and fury, commanded to bring Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Then they brought these men before the king. Nebuchadnezzar spoke and said unto them, "Is it true, O Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego? Do not ye serve my gods, nor worship the golden image which I have set up? Now if ye be ready that at that time that ye hear the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, sackbut, psaltery and dulcimer, and all kinds of music, to fall down and worship the image which I have made, well. But if ye worship not, ye shall be cast the same hour into the midst of a burning fiery furnace. And who is that God that shall deliver you out of my hands?" Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, "O Nebuchadnezzar, we are not careful to answer thee in this matter. If it be so, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us out of thine hand, O king. But if not, be it known unto thee, O king, that we will not serve thy gods, nor worship the golden image which thou hast set up." Then was Nebuchadnezzar full of fury, and the form of his visage was changed against Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Therefore he spoke and commanded that they should heat the furnace 7 times more than it was usually heated. And he commanded the most mighty men that were in his army to bind Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and to cast them into the burning fiery furnace. Then these men were bound in their coats, their stockings, and their turbans, and their other garments, and were cast into the midst of the burning fiery furnace. Therefore, because the king's command was urgent, and the furnace exceedingly hot, the flame of the fire slew those men that took up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And these three men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, fell down bound into the midst of the burning fiery furnace. Then Nebuchadnezzar the king was astounded and rose up in haste and spoke and said unto his counselors, "Did not we cast three men bound into the midst of the fire?" They answered and said unto the king, "True, O king." He answered and said, "Lo, I see four men loose, walking in the midst of the fire, and they have no hurt, and the form of the fourth is like the Son of God." Then Nebuchadnezzar came near to the mouth of the burning fiery furnace and spoke and said, "Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, ye servants of the Most High God, come forth and come here." Then Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came forth from the midst of the fire. And the princes, governors, and captains, and the king's counselors, being gathered together, saw these men, upon whose bodies the fire had no power, nor was an hair of their head singed, neither were their coats changed, nor the smell of fire had passed on them. Then Nebuchadnezzar spoke and said, "Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who hath sent his angel and delivered his servants who trusted in him, and hath changed the king's word, and yielded their bodies that they might not serve nor worship any god except their own God. Therefore I make a decree that every people, nation, and language who speak anything amiss against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be cut in pieces, and their houses shall be made a refuse heap, because there is no other God that can deliver after this sort." Then the king promoted Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the province of Babylon. A long chapter, and to us in our modern way of writing, there seems a lot of unnecessary repetition. But I'm sure as we read it through, that just adds to the wonder and the beauty of this, well, I was going to say fascinating story. It's a wonderful story, isn't it? After having read that, and you followed it, I hope, in your Bibles, is there anybody who can't spell Nebuchadnezzar? Because you can't help noticing how many times Nebuchadnezzar the king is mentioned in this chapter. I haven't bothered to count them. But you see, this chapter is coming along in this setting that we've seen of God dealing with this very proud and yet very mighty and very wise king, whom he has set up under his government to be the ruler of the whole world, and God is dealing with him to break down his pride and to make him realize, as he does in the end, that the God in heaven rules. You remember in chapter 1, he started on a low level by showing him that those who followed him and trusted in him were wiser than all, 10 times wiser than all those who had undergone his training and eaten his food. In chapter 2, Nebuchadnezzar learned that God alone could reveal secrets, certain secrets at any rate, that he was the one who could reveal the secrets that none of his wise men could reveal. And now in chapter 3, he's going to learn another lesson. He's going to learn that God is able to deliver out of his hands. And another blow is going to be struck at his pride to bring him down until at last he confesses who God is. But he hasn't got there yet at the end of this chapter, and we're just going to trace through and see what happens to both Nebuchadnezzar and, of course, these three men who were so prominent again in the chapter. You remember we mentioned that these were not old men. I don't know how long it was. It doesn't give us a date for this happening, but presumably they weren't so very much older when this happened. So we're dealing in, first of all, then, with Nebuchadnezzar's pride. And instead of allowing God's favor and God's dealings with him to bring down and to humble him in any way, in the beginning of this chapter, it seems that he sets up this great image as an object of worship. And although it doesn't actually say so, it does seem to suggest that this was an image of himself, or at least an image which represented him and his kingdom. We're not specifically told that, but when we remember that Daniel said, "Thou art this head of gold," there does seem a connection that a few years afterwards he sets up this fantastic image of gold in the plain of Dura. But God is going to bring him down and to show that pride has no place with God. Here's a verse from Psalm 138. "Though the Lord be high, yet hath he respect unto the lowly, but the proud he knoweth afar off." And God was looking down on this scene and seeing the actions of this proud monarch. Or we could turn to Proverbs verse 16, chapter 16 and verse 5. "Everyone who is proud of heart is an abomination to the Lord." And so God is going to demonstrate his power again and bring down this monarch before all his assembled audience, not in private this time, and show him that he is God. So Nebuchadnezzar sets up this great image. Set it up in the plains of Dura. It was a massive construction, nearly 100 feet high. You can imagine this colossal structure of a man, or an image at any rate, almost 100 feet high, of brilliant gold, standing up in this very level plain of Dura. And then for its dedication, he assembles all the principal men from all his vast domain. You remember when we turn to the book of Esther, it mentions the 120 provinces of Xerxes. Well, it wasn't quite the same with Babylon, but it did cover a very vast area of nations and tongues and languages, and so he brings them all together in order that he might demonstrate before them that he is the absolute ruler. Then he organizes this huge orchestra. Seems that he plucked every musical instrument from the category, doesn't it, as we read it through. He had this huge orchestra. He may have had more than one he'd have to have a loud noise for such a vast audience to hear it all at once. And no doubt he had more than one of these orchestras. Perhaps it went in a sort of jump from one to the other. As one played, the others took it up, and so on. And as soon as they heard it, they all had to bow down. The order was perfectly clear, wasn't it? When they heard the sound of the music, all they had to do was to bow down, that was to prostrate themselves on the ground and to worship his image. Quite simple. The penalty for not doing so was certain death by being thrown into the burning fiery furnace. Well, so the story starts. We don't know what was behind Nebuchadnezzar's mind when he concocted this vast idea. It might just have been pure personal pride, but possibly had a political motive in it. He had a country which was composed of very many different nations and very many different cultures and different languages. And if he could bring them together under their heads, represented by their heads, and bring them into this one act of devotion and worship, it would be a binding force, perhaps, in his empire. He might have had that thought, but really it's not very important what he was thinking. It's what happened afterwards that's important. So he has a musical accompaniment to help things on, and that would give the required sort of atmosphere. Well, what's that got to do with us today? This sort of thing is still with us today and has always been with the nations since God put rule into the hands of the nations. Man has used his authority given by God to usurp what is due to God. And instead of governing man in the way that he is allowed to do, he wants to bring man under duress to worship himself and to blind and to fetter his conscience so that he takes over the things that are due to God. Man has always tried in some way or another, by government or by individual, to demand in some way the rights that are due to God, particularly in worship and in the matter of conscience. And so very often religion has been brought in to support that. And often music has been brought in to give the right atmosphere to religion as well. If you think of it, it's gone on right the way through the times of the Gentiles. It's with us, as I say, today. You saw it in Roman Empire worship, emperor worship rather, and how many thousands of saints of God were obliterated, murdered, burnt, martyred in one way or another, just because they wouldn't bow down to the Roman empires or acknowledge allegiance to them. We were reading a book not so very long ago of a missionary who was in North Korea at the time, just before the Japanese war. And he told the story of how many, well, he didn't tell how many, but of numbers of North Korean Christians he himself put into prison because they wouldn't bow down to the Japanese empire, emperor, and acknowledge his godhead or his deity. It went on through the papal system, didn't it? But in a different way. They had to bow to Rome, and if you didn't bow to Rome, dire consequences followed. We get the same sort of thing going on in the communist world. You don't bow to the communist dictates, not to a man particularly, but to a system and to all its dictates. Never mind your own conscience. If you go against the conscience of the state and what the state says, then you'll find yourself in prison. And so it goes on, and it, of course, will be seen in its full-blown capacity right at the end of the age, when the beast and the false prophet set up an image and compel worship to that image on pain of death and taking away all rights of of gaining a livelihood to those who will not bear the mark of the image and worship his beast, worship his idol. Well, let's look on down the chapter. We're looking from verse 8 now down to verse 12. Let's try to picture this scene. There's this vast crowd, thousands upon thousands of these dignitaries, all gathered together in this huge plain of Dura. And there, standing in front of them, is this vast 100-foot image. And there's Nebuchadnezzar, probably on some form of dais, with all his splendor and glory, and all his retinue of soldiers around him. And then there's the band playing this great strain of music. And the whole vast crowd suddenly falls down on the ground, down on their faces. Can you imagine how proud Nebuchadnezzar must have felt as he looked at this vast scene? All these governors, all these representatives of his nation that he ruled over, and they're all down on their faces before him. But then there's a movement. And some of these Chaldeans move out from the crowd, and we see them going up towards Nebuchadnezzar, and we're allowed to hear what they say. We're going down to verse 10 now. They carefully show the king how they've understood the king's decree, and they go through it all again, word by word, verse 10 and 11. They remind him of what he said will happen to those who don't worship them, worship as he's asked them. And then we come to verse 12. Approach the king, O king, live forever. And then they've reminded him, now they say, there are certain Jews. Can you detect the hatred and the scorn in their very words? There are certain Jews. What's coming next? They put it that way, and everything they say is designed to inflame the pride and the anger of this king. They know how he's feeling and how he will feel. Doesn't say that, only that. There are certain Jews whom thou hast set over the affairs of Babylon. Your fault. They didn't say that. But there's the underlying suggestion, isn't there? You put these Jews, these despised foreigners, captives from Jerusalem, you put them over the province of Babylon. And you can tell their jealousy. These were the men who they'd been stepped over by, these Jews. And then what do they say? These men have not regarded thee. They serve not thy gods, nor do they worship the golden image which thou hast set up. Just notice that whenever we tell tales, we add a little bit to it. They add a little bit to what Nebuchadnezzar had never said anything about serving his gods. He just said that they had to bow down and worship his image. They've added a little bit. They won't serve your gods, nor worship your image. And you'll notice that after that, that bit comes in all the time. Well, perhaps these men were wise. Perhaps they realized that bowing down to that image wasn't just a bowing down to a lump of metal. It was an acknowledgement that they were bowing down to Nebuchadnezzar's idols, although he hadn't actually said so. As Paul says, what the Gentiles offer to idols, they really offer to demons. And these Chaldeans, of course, they were the men who traded with darkness and evil. They knew what was behind that golden image. They knew the implications of the worship of it. I wonder if we are always as wise. Do we always stop to consider the implications behind following something of the world's delusions or the world's attractions? Ah, we think it's quite harmless. Everybody does it. Do we forget that what might seem a simple, innocent, attractive pastime or enjoyment or a bit of reading or something to while away the time, it might not behind it be quite so innocuous? For the whole world lies in the wicked one, and everything that comes from that source is tainted by him. And it's a golden image, but behind it is the idol, and behind the idol is the whole power of darkness. So perhaps they were right when they said, they won't serve your gods. Now we go down to verses 13 to 18. We ask ourselves, how does the man of God act in such circumstances? And this is what we learn from Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. It's what comes out in the Epistle to Romans, and it comes out in the Lord's words, that as a general rule, the believer, whether in past times or in present day, the believer is bound to obey authority. He has to give obedience to the powers that be, recognizing that they've been set there by God. And that's his duty in the normal run of things, is to be obedient to the powers that be. But if the powers that be overstep the line and demand of him what can only be demanded rightly by God, then he has to stand against it. If they're asking him for worship, if they're asking him to disobey what has been strictly laid down by God, then he must disobey and hold fast to what is right. Now that's the clear line that comes out here. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego had been quite, I wouldn't say pleased, they'd been quite happy to be in Nebuchadnezzar's government and to rule under him and to obey his commands. But at this point, everything was changed, and they stood firm for what was of God, whatever it may cost. Now let's have a look. Nebuchadnezzar, verse 13, in his rage and fury commanded to bring Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Oh yes, now he's a different man altogether, isn't he? That smile's gone completely off his face, that smile of satisfaction, and it's changed completely. And in spite of the fact that at the end of the last chapter, he was talking about God as being the God of gods and the Lord of kings, he's forgotten all about that. And because three men have dared to flout his commands, He's in a fury and in a temper. His pride has been attacked, his pride has been shattered. And he commands that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego should be brought, and these men were brought before the king. Well, it took him a bit of time, perhaps, to get them there. And in that time, Nebuchadnezzar seems to have calmed down a bit, doesn't he? And in verse 14, he seems to take a very tolerant sort of attitude towards them, doesn't he? He goes through it all again, and he says, "Is it true that you don't serve my gods, nor worship the golden image which I've set up?" And he doesn't stop for an answer. He says, "Now, if you are ready to do it when you hear the sound of music, all very well." He gives them another chance. Amazing, really, isn't it? After all that he said, that he seems to give them another chance. "All very well. But if you worship, don't worship, then you'll be cast in the midst of a burning fiery furnace." But you notice that he's put in the little bit that the other men put in. "Is it true, O Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, don't you serve my gods?" He's added that little bit. You see, it's come in now again, "or worship the golden image that I've set up." And now comes the first of three very significant ifs in verse 15. "If ye worship not, if ye be ready," "at that time, then all well if you worship. If ye worship not, you'll be cast into the midst of the fire." I'm going to call this, there are three ifs in these next verses. I'm going to call this first one the ifs of the devil's testing. The ifs of the devil's testing. The devil often tests us by ifs in this way. First of all, it might be an if that casts doubt. It doesn't use the word if in the story of the Garden of Eden, but there's very much an if in it, in Satan's words, isn't there? He doesn't actually use the word if, but it was as if he said, "If you eat of the fruit of the tree, you'll become as gods." He put an if of doubt, into the mind of Eve. Sometimes the if might cast a doubt on our relationships with God. That is how he tempted the Lord himself, wasn't he? "If you be the Son of God, make these stones into bread." But so often it's an if that promises and threatens, just as it was here. "If you'll do this, I'll give you blessing, I'll give you prosperity. If you follow me, everything will be all right. If you don't, then look out." He either cajoles or he threatens. Is an angel of light or a lion going about seeking whom he may devour? It's happening in the communist world. If you follow the communist line, yes, you'll get on. You'll have every possibility of having a fine education. You can be trained as an athlete. You can have all the pleasures of the state. Everything will be poured out to you if you follow the line. If you don't, you might land up in concentration camp or something even worse. And especially if it's a question of following God. Because it's the devil who's behind it. And this is the sort of if that Nebuchadnezzar uses. And Nebuchadnezzar here is a very apt picture of the one who's behind him, of Satan himself. "If you do as I say, everything well. If you don't do as I say, well, the fiery furnace. And who is that God who'll deliver you out of my hand?" And in his bloated pride, he brings God into it now. He's brought his own gods into it, And now he brings God into it and says, who's that God who's able to deliver you out of my hand? And so the conflict moves now from being a conflict between Nebuchadnezzar and three poor Jews, between a conflict between Nebuchadnezzar and the mighty God of heaven. Oh, how good it is to realize, isn't it, that as we move through this world and come against opposition, that if we're serving the Lord, it's not us against the enemy. We're only there in relation to the Lord, and the battle is the Lord's. And he's the one who is going to carry us through to victory. Let's stop a moment and just try to think again of the situation that these three young men found themselves in. There they are, three youths, alone, aliens from their commonwealth, aliens from their own country. They've been in this land for some time, I know, but they're foreigners. There's that great image set up. And here's the king with all his might and power represented by his soldiery around him. And there in front of them are all these thousands upon thousands of men who have willingly bowed down before the idol. Where are they going to turn for help in such circumstances? They were absolutely, naturally speaking, out there on their own, weren't they? Can we just try and imagine what it must have been like for those three young Jews standing in such a circumstances? What would we have done? So easy just to have bowed down, wouldn't it? Who's going to know? Well, how gloriously they come out, don't they? Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego said to the king, O Nebuchadnezzar, we are not careful to answer thee in this matter. Their answer stands as an all-time example of faithfulness even unto death, doesn't it? But God gave them wisdom in their answer. We're not careful to answer thee in this matter. They weren't being flippant, nor were they being overbold. Perhaps not a very good translation, that. It means really, we don't have any need to answer you. There's no need to answer you in this matter. Why? Two reasons. They might have said to Nebuchadnezzar, by what you know of us already, you know what the answer is going to be. You don't need to ask us. You know enough about us, Nebuchadnezzar, and how we've stood. You don't need to answer. We don't need to answer you. You've got the answer in our lives. That was a testimony, wasn't it? Or they might have said to Nebuchadnezzar, well, you've taken the matter out of our hands now, Nebuchadnezzar. It's not between us and you. It's between us and God. And we're not going to answer. We don't need to answer. We'll leave it with God. And so there comes in this second if. If it be so, our God whom we serve, he's able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us out of thine hand, O king. If it be so, listen, the God whom we serve. They've taken up his language, you notice. You won't serve my gods. No, they say, the God whom we serve. Oh yes, they're already booked. You can't serve God and mammon. You can't serve God and idols. And they were serving God, so they couldn't serve his gods. The answer was there. Our God, whom we serve, is able to deliver us, if he wants. He is able. And then the second if. The if of complete committal, even to death. But if not, be it known unto thee, O King, we will not serve thy gods, nor worship the golden image which thou hast set up. And this has been the stand of thousands upon thousands upon thousands of faithful men and women, and even boys and girls, throughout the history of the church, who in one way or another have said, but if not, we will not bow down, we will not serve, we will not give way, we will not deny. And they've sealed it with their blood. Rather than deny the one that they serve. Oh, how these things touch us, don't they? And we ask ourselves, where would we stand in such circumstances? Well, we haven't been asked to stand like that, and we don't know, because God doesn't give grace that isn't necessary. But what was God's answer to these faithful men? We're reading now down from verses 19 to 25. Well, having received such an answer in front of all his soldiers and in front of these governors, Nebuchadnezzar completely drops his mask now. No nice smile, no sweetness about him now. The form of his visage was changed against Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And he commands that the furnace should be heated 7 times. See, not only had they disobeyed him, but now they'd openly challenged him, as he saw it, in front of all his people. These 3 foreign Jews that he'd favored by giving them a place of authority in his kingdom, and this is how they were repaying him. That was his attitude before all this vast audience of princes. So, heat the furnace 7 times. You see, when a man loses his temper and loses his control, he says some stupid things sometimes. At least this appears to me a stupid thing. I mean, what use was it to heat the furnace 7 times? Any furnace would have burnt them up if they were thrown into it, wouldn't it? I mean, a furnace heated 7 times wouldn't do the job any better, would it? I mean, looking at it naturally. But here's a man who's so full of his fury, he's got to show that he's mad. Heat the furnace 7 times. Why had he got that furnace there anyway? Why did he have that furnace ready? I think, you know, somehow, right at the very start, when he was planning that image going up, he had the suspicion at the back of his mind that there were some Jews who were not going to bow down. And to try and force them to it, he'd got the furnace already there to frighten them into obedience. Ah, that's the devil all over, isn't it? Pharaoh was just the same, wasn't he? When Moses went to him and asked for permission as soon as the plague started, then what did he do? He made things worse. He took away the straw and made them make bricks without straw. And so it goes on right the way through. Satan with Job. He took away his family and his belongings first. Then when he found that didn't work, instead of giving in and say, yes, God, you were right, he says, well, let me touch his health. Now that's Satan all over. Make the matter worse. Heat the furnace 7 times and we'll break them somehow. The wonderful thing is that God gives the power even against such circumstances. So these men were bound in their coats, their stockings, their turbans, and all their other garments, and were cast in the fire. It's an amazingly photographic picture, this, isn't it? It's a beautiful story, this. It's so accurate in its details. You can see these soldiers, and there's such a hurry. They don't bother to undress them at all. Just as they were, they get the ropes round them as quick as they can, because the king's message was urgent. Here's Nebuchadnezzar in charge now. Everything's going fine. Seems like. Therefore, verse 22, and now God steps in. Because the king's commandment was urgent and the furnace exceeding hot, the fire slew the men that threw them in. Nebuchadnezzar commanded the most mighty men that were in his army. And those mighty men of Nebuchadnezzar's army bound those poor three poor weak Jews and threw them into the fire. And what happened? God puffed with his wind and the flames came out and burnt them up. That's God. When God moves, none can stand in his way. He doesn't always move to save his people like that, but here he did. And he moved first of all in judgment against these mighty men. And the three men fell down bound into the midst of the furnace. God didn't deliver them out of the furnace. They went into the furnace. Isaiah had said, speaking of Jehovah, as from Jehovah, when thou walkest through the fire, thou shalt not be burned, neither shall the flame kindle upon thee. And here it was coming absolutely true, wasn't it? Perhaps those very men, as they went down into the fire, would be thinking of that promise of Isaiah's. And what does he say to us? I will never leave thee, nor forsake thee. So we may boldly say, the Lord is my helper, and I will not fear what man shall do unto me. And the promises to us as well. So, verse 24, Nebuchadnezzar watching to see the end of these rebellious Jews. And then he's astounded. Astonishment, confusion. He not only sees them walking free in the midst of the fire. Didn't we cast 3 men in bound? But not only were they walking free, unharmed, but he sees a 4th one. And he says he's like the Son of God. The Lord hasn't saved them out of the fire. He's done something more wonderful. He's come and joined them in it. And that's what God sometimes does as he passes us through the trial, isn't it? He doesn't always save us out of the trial. Sometimes he does. Sometimes he comes to us in the trial and he walks through the trial with us. Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I'll fear no evil, for you'll not let me go into it. Doesn't say that, does it? For thou art with me, thy rod and thy staff, they comfort me. And how many of us have had the experience of going through hard times and going through difficulties, not in the sense that they have, but testings and trials. God hasn't saved us out of them. He saved us in them, as he did here with these three men. He came down into the fire with them. Perhaps only Nebuchadnezzar saw the form of the Son of God. But there it was true. As it is true spiritually for us, so in a day to come will it be true for the remnant in the day of the great tribulation, when the Lord makes his presence felt with them, not saving them out of it, but bearing them through it and coming down amongst them in spirit. That's what so many of the Psalms are about. And the Psalms will be taken up by the remnant in that day as comfort when they know that their Messiah is amongst them, going through with them, not in actual physical presence here, but in spiritual presence with them, and able to carry them through, some of them right through. Well, Nebuchadnezzar sees them, so he starts to act. Now you notice in verses 26 to verse 30, Nebuchadnezzar's confession this time goes a little bit further. We said at the beginning that God was going to bring Nebuchadnezzar down, and he has done. He's had to admit before all these vast audience that here these men that were thrown into the furnace have come out unharmed, and God has been able to deliver them. So he says to them, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, notice, ye servants, you're serving them, ye servants. He acknowledges it. Now listen to the terms he uses now. Ye servants of the God of gods? No. The servants of the Most High God. One of the glorious titles of God as the ruler of the whole earth. As Melchizedek came out to meet Abraham, priest of the Most High God. And here's Nebuchadnezzar taking up this very term, servants of the Most High God. Where did he learn it from? I'm sure he learned it from Daniel, from Shadrach, from Meshach and Abednego. He couldn't have learned it from anyone else. Servants of the Most High God, come forth and come here. And so they came out. And when God saves a man, he saves him to the uttermost. That's New Testament, isn't it? He saves to the uttermost all those who come to God by him. Spiritually, we can apply it. Here, physically, he didn't just save them out of the fire, and they didn't come out with bits of burnt clothes on them and scars all over their body from the flames. They came out absolutely unscathed. I don't know how God did it. No good asking me or anyone else to explain it. This is God stepping into his world of physical things. And God can do that when he likes and when he wishes. He doesn't often do it. But he can use the laws of the universe as he alone can. And here, somehow or other, he breaks through the laws of the universe and he brings these men out from those burning fiery furnace, and you can't even smell smoke on them. You men know that if you've had a bonfire in the garden, you don't have to tell your wife that you've had a bonfire. It smells on your clothes, doesn't it? And it smells in the bedroom when you take your clothes off. You can't get near fire without it coming. Can't smoke a cigarette even without your mother knowing, can you? It gets into things. And here they came without the slightest taint. Oh, how wonderfully God can save. And when he takes us to glory and he saves us in his final salvation, there'll not be one slightest taint of what earth speaks of and what sin speaks of. Not a hair of their head singed, not one tiniest bit of damage. And their clothes just as intact as when they went in. Now listen to Nebuchadnezzar's confession. Then Nebuchadnezzar spoke and he blessed the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. What did he say about God? He sent his angels and delivered his sent his angel and delivered his servant. Oh, that was an admission, wasn't it? Who is that God who's able to deliver out of my hand? Now he's saying, yes, he's blessed the God who sent his servant and he delivered them. He has to admit it. And hath changed the king's word. Now he is a God who can change the king's word. The king had made his word and made his decree, but here's God who steps in and changes the king's word. That's the God now that he's had to deal with, and that's the God he's recognizing. What does he say about God's servants? Well, he calls them the servants. They trusted in him. Oh, what a testimony. They trusted in him. They trusted in him. What a thing to be written over our lives, wouldn't it be? They trusted. He trusted in God. It's what was said of the Lord on the cross, wasn't it? He trusted in him. Let him deliver him now if he'll have him. That was the testimony of that wonderful life of the Lord. They trusted in God. Who trusted in him. And yielded their bodies. And yielded their bodies. This is 12th of Romans, isn't it? And yielded their bodies that they might not serve nor worship any God except their own God. Oh, this is the first two verses of the 12th of Romans, isn't it? Yield yourselves to God. And here they had done in actuality. Just the last verse. Still a lot of confusion, though, in Nebuchadnezzar's thinking. He's still a long way to go yet. He makes a decree. I don't know what you think of it, but I think it's a rather weak and a rather negative one, isn't it? He doesn't say that people have to worship God. He says that if they speak anything against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, because there's no other God that can deliver after this sort. That was an admission anyway. But he hasn't learned his lesson yet, has he? He thinks that all you have to do to make God people worship, or make them not worship, or make them love God or not love God, whichever way we're looking at it, all you have to do is threaten them. Doesn't work like that, does it? You can't compel people to worship. You can't compel people to worship God, nor could these people be compelled to worship an idol. Nebuchadnezzar couldn't be compelled to worship God. The Thessalonians turned to God from idols to serve the living and true God. But what had happened first? They'd had repentance. They'd had faith. They'd been born again. And to bring about this, God is going to work still further with Nebuchadnezzar. And in the next chapter, we'll see how God brings him right down to bring him to this place of repentance that he can really worship God.